Leading LDS is a nonprofit organization dedicated to enhancing leadership ability and capacity of lay leaders in order to accelerate the mission of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Leading LDS is not owned nor operated by the LDS Church, and any opinions expressed on this podcast do not reflect the views of any specific organization. All donations given to Leading LDS are tax deductible and go towards the support of Leading LDS. For more information, visit leadinglds.org. Hey, it's me again, Kurt Frankum, the host of the Leading LDS podcast. And one thing you may not know about me is my mother was Relief Society president when I was born. So I think she coughed on me and gave me the leadership germ or something. But I digress. In this episode, it's a How I Lead episode where we find the most prolific leaders, the most experienced leaders, whether they think so or not, and sit them down and ask them some questions of how is it that you lead? And today we're talking with our Relief Society president, Amy Durham, and a big shout out to Bishop Lash, who recommended that Amy be on the How I Lead segment. And Kevin Lash is a longtime listener to the Leading LDS podcast, and I've had opportunity to meet him several times. And love you, brother. Thanks for all you do to support Leading LDS. The interesting thing about Amy Durham is she served in a traditional family ward in Utah as a Relief Society president, but she was also single. And so we talk about some of those dynamics that come up of being a Relief Society president, but single, and maybe some strengths that come to that, some weaknesses, but really good interview. Has some solid advice for those wards that have high levels of welfare. So here's my interview with Amy Durham. In the corporate headquarters of Deseret Book with Amy Durham. How are you, Amy?
Good. How are you doing?
Very good. Well, you were recommended to me by a listener who's a bishop, who is your bishop, and he said, I've got the best Relief Society president that you definitely need to interview. So
far, the only Relief Society president he had
worked with. Okay. So you're his favorite, but only his only one. I guess you were recently released. So
yes.
Very good. Well, I appreciate you meeting with me. And what is it you do for Deseret Book?
I'm the director of production, which is probably the most boring job in the publishing department.
So you're not like
this. I get to work with all the editors and designers, and yeah. I just help get the books printed and into the warehouse and out to the stores so that people can have access to those resources.
Nice. And what got you into this industry? How did you end up here?
Oh, by chance, mostly. I majored in psychology, which is about like majoring in nothing. And so after college, I was thinking of possibly going back to grad school, and I got a job in the meantime working at a book bindery. And it just kind of I got a part-time job later working at Deseret Book, and then they needed somebody helping with production, and they had seen on my resume that I had bindery experience, and so they knew I had some experience in the production area.
Oh,
and
wow.
It just kind of snowballed, and I got sucked in from there.
Nice. And we talked a little bit about what you do here and the madness that you some days are, and basically you make sure the books are on the shelf and the new books are getting to the shelves and everything's moving through your systems here.
Yeah. I mean, it's a huge big team,
right?
Process,
it's not just you, right?
Yeah, no, thank goodness.
Cool.
But yeah, I work with a really great group of people that get things edited and designed and
yeah. And how long have you been here then?
All told, about 10 years.
Mm-hmm. Great. And good place to.
It's a great place to
be.
Work.
In.
Yeah,
good.
It's. I get to work with some of the best people. So.
Oh, that's
great.
Awesome. That's great. So let's talk about kind of put your life in perspective here before we jump into your leadership experience. And so I'll fire some rapid fire questions at you, and they don't have to be rapid answers. So answer how you will. But where were you raised?
Salt Lake City.
Okay. And when did you get baptized?
When I was 8.
Okay. So pretty traditional upbringing in the church.
Very.
Okay. Lifelong pioneer heritage.
Yeah. On both sides of the family, in fact.
Great. And did you serve a mission?
I did not.
Okay. And where did you say you went to college?
I went to Oregon State University.
Oh, the Beavers, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Packed.
Go Beavs.
12, right? Okay. And you're not married.
I am not married.
Okay. And that's going to play into our interview here. And I'm sure you planned it out this way, right?
Totally,
just like
yeah.
Every single person.
Yeah, that's, I wanted to be a middle-aged single woman. That was my goal.
Nice. Well, have you ever met an apostle?
I mean,
don't they just walk through these halls
they
here?
No. My dad was president of Deseret Book and later president of ZCMI.
Oh, okay.
So he had cause to interact with them on occasion, and he passed away when I was in my mid-20s. And
oh, wow.
So during the course of his illness and at his funeral and stuff, you know, that he had blessings and we had met, you know, Elder Maxwell was a good friend of his and Elder Ballard was a good friend of his and spoke at his funeral. And
wow.
So not for really super fun reasons, but
but that's great. And to hear that they, you know, he was obviously closely influenced by some of those leaders. That's great. Now, everybody loves General Conference in the church. So when you think of General Conference, what's the first conference talk that comes to mind?
Ever or from this last one?
That's whatever. Hard. Just the first one.
Okay. Well, weirdly, I thought of Elder Holland's Broken Vessel.
Oh, yeah.
Because I feel like it was kind of a groundbreaking. It wasn't something, you know, struggles with mental illness and depression and that kind of thing is not something that you hear addressed often in a broad audience like that. And I was Relief Society president at the time. And I felt really grateful for that talk because I knew how many people there were that struggled with that, and it made them feel like outliers and it made them feel different. And I was so grateful to have an apostle stand up in front of the church and address it in a way that was like so accepting and so loving.
Yeah, that's awesome. Great, great choice. Staying on the topic of General Conference, what is your General Conference tradition?
Pajamas.
Pajamas, that's it.
I do have some friends who it's not always the same session, but we try to get together for one of the morning sessions and do breakfast.
Oh, great.
But really, other than that, it really is just pajamas on.
Keep the
couch.
Dresses in the closet.
Oh, okay. I am not a dress person. I look forward to conference for that reason.
Nice. What makes you a unique Mormon?
Well, I'm aside from the fact that I'm middle-aged and single.
Okay, right.
That's pretty unique, especially in Utah. I am a Democrat.
Oh, really? And we're recording this on...
I don't care.
On voting day, so...
That's right.
Good. Hey, and that's great. I'm glad you mentioned that. Nothing wrong with a Democrat Mormon, for sure. What leadership callings have you had? Obviously, we've said Relief Society president. Any before that, even if they weren't, you know, official leadership callings?
In my last word, I was young women's president, and also in the young women's presidency. So I was in the presidency and then later the president. And then other than that, I was in a Relief Society presidency in a singles ward years ago. And otherwise, I've mostly taught either gospel doctrine or Relief Society. I've kind of flopped back and forth between those two callings quite a bit.
Oh, great. And so thinking of your time serving in the youth program, what's the solid like go-to advice that you'd give to other young women leaders?
You've got to be consistent and you've got to call leaders that are consistent. I mean, you're working with a group that is at a point where they're really for the first time making decisions that are going to affect their whole lives. And they're making them for themselves. Their parents aren't making their decisions for them anymore. And they're right at a period where they're really figuring out where they're going to direct their lives. And you're in a position of trust with them that, you know, sometimes they won't talk to their parents. And so to be somebody that they can rely on and somebody that they can go to and have a conversation with without feeling judged, I think is really important. And then you've got to be there. I mean, you've got to be there. You can't be hit and miss, I think, when that calling. I honestly think that's one of the more important callings is working with the youth.
Yeah.
You got to be solid when you're doing that.
Yeah, I like that. When you talk about, you know, they're in a phase of life where they're finally making decisions for themselves, even if the parents think they're still making the decision for them, right? Mm-hmm. Whether it's internally or, you know, I'll just hang on till I get out of the house and then I'll, you know, carry through with these decisions. So I think being honest with yourself with saying, you know, that's what's happening and whether we like it or not, that's going on. So that's great. So tell us a story about how you were called as a Relief Society president.
I moved into the ward and I was going to just be there temporarily. My brother had taken a work position where he was just going to be out of the state for 3 years and he didn't want to have to sell his house. And I had been looking at moving from my neighborhood. So I sold my house to kind of house sit for him for a couple of years and just save up some money to, you know, buy something different when he got back. And so I had moved into his ward and they were gone. And I had been in the ward for maybe 6 weeks. And the bishop, the previous to Bishop Lash, kind of poked his head into Sunday school one day and did the like, hooking his finger at me, calling me out of class. And
to the principal's office.
Yeah, yeah. And in my head, I immediately thought, oh, well, I'm getting a calling and it's going to be a teaching calling because that's what my callings always are. Mm-hmm. And so I went and sat down in the room and he's like, we'd like to extend a calling to you. And I was like, yeah, yeah. And he's like, and we'd like to extend the calling to be the Relief Society president. And I started laughing. Yeah. And I said, I know the names of like five women in this ward.
Yeah, you're brand new,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it's brand new. And he was kind of smiling and he said, I know. And he said, so we're telling you a little bit in advance. We probably won't make the change for another couple of weeks to give you some time to kind of like, and I was like, meet some people.
Right.
And he said, yeah. And I said, you know, I'm not that nice and I can't talk in that voice.
What do you mean that voice?
Oh, everybody knows what that voice is.
the Relief Society president voice?
Relief Society voice.
This is new to me. So yeah, this is it like the overly
very, I don't want to offend anybody.
The people that actually were born with that voice.
Yeah, I'm a tomboy with three big brothers. And so okay. I don't have a super sweet voice or demeanor, either one.
Yeah, okay.
But he laughed and he thought, you know, and I agree with him, but one of the things that he thought was that in some ways it was an advantage that I didn't know anybody because I had no preconceived ideas about anyone in the ward, about who could or would accept a calling or a position or who would be friends or who would behave in any certain way. And as hard as it was to try and like put together visiting teaching when I had no idea when they were all just names on a list. And I didn't know if I was matching up a 19-year-old inactive sister with a, you know, 85-year-old widow.
Yeah.
Those parts of it were really hard, but it was also kind of cool to serve and not have any ideas about who the women were that I was serving. To learn to know them and to learn to love them as I was serving was kind of a neat experience, actually.
Yeah. So how did what are those weeks, how do they transpire after that, leading up to the official sustaining and call? What processes were you going through at that point?
At that point, I kind of felt like a stalker at church. Like I was like looking or, you know, just kind of like watching to see, you know, how women interacted and who would talk with me and what sort of impressions that I had with sisters that I met and spoke with and the kinds of comments that sisters made in Relief Society and in Sunday school to try and get an idea of who these women were. Mm-hmm. And then there was some, you know, as anyone should, when they're choosing counselors, there was some praying about it and talking with the bishop. And he helped me a little bit with, you know, who was available and who might be effective, you know, in those positions. But then it was kind of up to me to make the decision in the end. He was great as well. He was the bishop before Bishop Lash was also very like, this is your presidency. So I'll support you however I can, but these are your decisions and I trust you to make them.
That's great. That's empowering.
Yeah.
You know, to hear that from a bishop. So, and this kind of leads into your first leadership principles as far as honestly assessing your own strengths
and weaknesses,
right? That's a maybe underscore the weaknesses.
Underscore the weaknesses.
So is that kind of the process you were going through as you were listening and assessing the women in Relief Society?
For sure. As you mentioned, I'm single. I've never been married and I don't have kids. And this is a regular family ward. And I don't know what a new mom needs and how many meals a new mom needs. And I don't know what it's like to be a young mom at home with kids and what kind of stress and worry goes along with that or how isolating that can be. And I wanted to make sure that there was representation in my presidency that did understand that and that could help me navigate that. And, you know, there are other strengths and weaknesses. I was new to the ward. I wanted to make sure that there was somebody in my presidency who could help me know who people were when names came up, who had a solid history in the ward. And, you know, whatever my personality quirks, you know,
we all got them right?
over being overly direct. Sometimes I needed somebody who was like very soft. Sometimes who gets
someone who had the voice, right?
Yeah, that's right. Somebody who could temper me a little bit. Nice. And so I thought about those things when I chose my counselors and I purposefully chose a sister who was a senior and a sister who was in the throes of motherhood with a child in junior high and one in high school and one in grade school and another who was just starting out her family with just one toddler. And she actually had her second one while we were in our presidency. And so I purposely chose a really good mix to help make up for where I knew I would be weak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great. And did you feel like who you ended up with created a pretty good balance? I mean, I guess there's it's never perfect, but
yeah, I think they really did. I think for sure. And I've said this to them many times, is that I was so grateful that they're good at the things that I'm not good at.
That's great.
Which I think was helpful for everyone.
And before we go into the other leadership principles you have down here, I wanted to go back a little bit and just maybe describe the demographics of your ward. Obviously it's in Utah, so maybe there's some similarities to other Utah wards, but how would you describe the demographics of your ward and or the unique challenges your ward faced?
We had actually I'm still there, a really even mix. We've got young marrieds and new families just starting out. We've got families with teenagers. We've got empty nesters. We've got, you know, widows and widowers. We've got single moms. That it really is a really good even mix. And I like that about the ward. We have a set of apartment buildings in our boundaries that are kind of low income. And so there's a lot of turnover there, and there are some unique challenges with that. And that took a lot of energy and a lot of planning and a lot of meeting to talk about how to meet the needs of the people who were in those apartment buildings.
Interesting. And did you have, was there a lot of youth in the ward then?
Yeah. I mean, not a lot of youth like South Jordan.
Right. Hundreds of youth.
But we have, it's a pretty decent mix all the way across the board.
Great.
Yeah.
That's
it's great. Nice. I like it.
Oh, that's great. So the second principle you put, and this is one that I see on a lot of lists, is delegate. So how do you go about delegating? How did you determine what you should do and what others should do?
This is going to make me sound really lazy, but anything that somebody else could do, I delegated. And not, I mean, I think you have to think about delegation, not just for your own sake, but for the sake of the growth of others as well. I mean, they've been called and set apart for a reason.
Yeah.
And I think you've got to trust that the Lord will help them magnify their callings the same way he helps you magnify your calling, and allow them to have space to do it differently. Even if it's maybe not the way you would have done it in the long run, most of these things, it probably doesn't matter what the menu was or what the decorations were, you know, whether you liked them or not, that kind of thing doesn't matter. So if you're giving those growth opportunities to somebody else to serve, and particularly when you're in the position as the Relief Society president or the bishop, there are some things that you have to do, right? That only you can do.
Right.
And a lot of those things are heavy.
Right.
And so I think for your own sake and for your own sanity, you delegate. And I think it's something that benefits both parties if you can allow it to happen and not feel like everything has to be your responsibility to do. If you have a compassionate service committee and you have needs in the ward, say to the compassionate service committee, you know, here are a list of people that are feeling lonely right now. If you guys have chances to go out and visit or want to drop something by, or here are some people who have birthdays coming up, or here are some people who are new to the ward, and just let them go.
Yeah.
Let them do it. They've been set apart in that calling. Trust them that they're going to do it.
Yeah. And they may not do it exactly how you would have done
it.
No,
they may not. But I have been like amazed and grateful to watch the sisters in our ward rise to the occasion and do what's been asked and more. And they can't do that if you don't delegate and give them those opportunities.
Yeah. Now, you kind of joked that you didn't want to sound lazy, but what were the things that, since you didn't do a lot of those administrative things, which is great, you delegated that. What were you focusing on? What was your goals there?
Well, I mean, a lot of the things that I had felt like I had to do myself.
Since all the admin stuff was off your plate, what did you do in that case?
Well, so things like food orders are real, you know, the handbook kind of specifies that that's something that, where possible, the Relief Society president and the bishop should handle those kinds of things. And so that, and the meeting with the bishop and I met and discussed some of the trickier family situations, those kinds of things. There were some things like visits where the bishop and I knew the situation in the home, but maybe other people didn't. And so those kinds of visits I needed to do. And there's just, we belong to a church with lots of meetings.
Yeah. And so you were going to those meetings.
And as the president, I go to all the ward councils, and I go to all the welfare meetings, and I go to all the presidency meetings, and I go to all the stake trainings. And so a lot of my time is taken up meeting and planning. And so then the delegation comes after that, when we're like, here are the assignments and who can help us, you know, get those things done.
Let's talk about you did quite a few food orders in your time as Relief Society president. What was that welfare process like, and what role did you play in that? I think every ward does a little differently. I'd be interested to hear how you did it?
When I started, I remember getting the handoff from the previous Relief Society, and she kind of showed me how to do one. And I remember thinking, oh man, I hope I don't ever have to do one of these. I just worried that it would be uncomfortable for me and for the person getting the food order. And so I was nervous about doing it at first. And I look back at that now and I laugh because
you could do one in your sleep
now. I've done lots. And also it was another one of those things with being single with no kids. Like I knew how to shop for one person. I'm not even going to say I know how to cook for one person because I don't really cook.
Yeah.
So I had an idea of the amount of food a person needed.
Yeah.
But a family of four, I'm like kind of trying to rapidly do math in my head to like, is this really how much a person needs? And so it was a learning curve a little bit for me too. And after a time, I sort of thought there are some people I could tell who were being very careful and very judicious in asking for food orders and planning. And there were others who I felt like, whether intentional or not, weren't planning as carefully and were maybe just kind of checking off the things that looked good.
Yeah.
Oh, that looks good. I'll take
it. And fill the cupboards and we'll figure out how we eat it later.
Then we'll use it later. And I think we talked before we started recording here about one of the cool things about working here is that there are lots of you can walk down the hall and find somebody who is or has been a bishop or a Relief Society president or a Young Men's president and kind of bounce ideas off each other or get ideas, ask advice. And I actually had a coworker and a friend here who had been a Relief Society president in an area where she has to fill far more food orders than I ever had to. And we were talking about it. And she is actually the one who shared with me that she had this whole packet that she used that she gave to people that they had to use when they filled out food orders. And I asked her to send it to me. And I thought it was great. And I sort of tailored it for our ward. And basically what it is like a 2-week menu plan where we asked the people, you know, to make an appointment to, you know, don't just call and say, I need a food order tonight and expect that I'm going to run right over there and do it. But we're going to do food orders on Sundays and Wednesdays. So plan if you're going to run out of food, if you plan ahead a little bit, the way anybody else does. And plan if you want to do it on a Sunday or Wednesday, and I'm available those days. And then here's this menu plan, and I expect you to, you know, plan out what your menu is going to be for the next couple of weeks. And then let's actually look at your menu and make sure that what you're ordering matches up with what your needs are for the next couple of weeks, rather than just kind of like ballparking what you think you might need. And it was just interesting to see the effect that had on the amounts of food and supplies that people were ordering. And again, I don't know that it was necessarily intentional. I think it was more just a lack of planning skills. Like it was not something that a lot of them had practiced before.
Yeah.
And so I think it was good exercise. It takes a little more time to do it that way, but I think it was a good exercise for them. And I think it was smarter for us as a ward to do it that way. It helped us be a little bit more careful with the resources that we had to.
And I love the fact that you're setting boundaries and expectations that, you know, I remember as a bishop many times, and I was in a very welfare heavy ward where someone would call me up and need something that night. And to be honest, like I probably could have gone over there and I wasn't really doing anything. You know, I was just home with my family, or whatever, but I would just draw that boundary because as people realize that this wasn't a quick process, like an overnight process, they began to respect the process a little bit more. And it really helped slow down the process so I could kind of think about it and receive that inspiration or you know, just consider all aspects of the situation. And I think, you know, setting those boundaries is crucial.
Yeah.
So this packet, is this something that we could get a copy of, or is it too, I mean,
probably, I mean,
maybe send it to me. We'll look at it and I'll make sure, you know,
it's some of it is like the resources that the church provides that kind of show, like spells out, this is kind of what a serving size is for each of the for the things that the Bishop Storehouse has. And then there's like a sample menu plan, and there's a blank menu plan for them to fill out. And then there's just like a little cover letter that has my contact information and the days that we do food orders. And this is what the expectations are. And, you know, it's not for food storage, and it's meant to last for 2 weeks because it's not meant to be a permanent thing. It's meant to be a holdover.
Love that.
The times that you need it. And
great boundaries there. So when somebody, so someone would call the bishop and say, I need food, or would they call you, or?
Both.
Okay.
For some who had done food orders before and kind of understood the drill, they would sometimes just call me directly. Uh-huh. But sometimes they would, if they were new to the ward or if they hadn't done one before, they would often contact a bishop first.
Okay. And then would you take a packet over to them, this mm-hmm. packet, and say, read through this and we'll see us on these days that we do food orders?
Usually if on the very first one, I would just sit down with them and do a food order. Okay. Because
they didn't know the process.
Yeah, they didn't know the process, and maybe they really were really out of things. Yeah. And I'm not going to say, oh, well, catch me on Sunday and then we'll get you milk.
if you can survive.
Yeah. So usually for the first one, we would just sit down and do it. And then I would show them the packet and I would say, okay, for next time, this is how we do this.
Yeah.
And so that they had some preparation and they had the packet there. And then we just left a stack of blank menu, you know, sample or menu plans in the bishop's office and told him, you know, you can make a copy of this one, or if you ever need another one, that there'll always be some sitting in the bishop's office. So there's not ever a reason for you to show up to this meeting and say you don't have your menu plan because you didn't have a menu plan to fill out.
Yeah. And, you know, we had a similar packet in my ward. It was interesting to see the process of, you know, people that were new to this, you know, obviously we'd help them and then they'd see the process, the steps they needed to take. And it, you know, for me, it didn't seem like a lot, but for them, you know, a lot of these people are living sort of day to day, and this is just sort of the culture that they have sort of grew up in and live in. And I'm not trying to sound disparaging but that's just their world, right? And so then they would see this, and a lot of, I think, bishops or religious day presidents may say, well, you know, we want to make sure everybody works for something. And so you need to go put in this amount of hours at the bishop storehouse and that. And those things, options are there and good. But sometimes I found like just this process of sitting down doing a menu is like so much work to them that it earns them the food, right? And so, but at the same time, it helps them build that skill set.
Those planning skills. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the next time it was so cool after a few times to see them say, hey, I've got my menu here. Like I'm ready to mm-hmm. go. And like, we're not trying to find reasons not to help them. Because there were some that suddenly they disappear and you think, oh, well, I guess the menu was too much for mm-hmm. them, right? And it's too bad. But at the same time, when you see that working, it's encouraging because you think, wow, this is, they really want this. They're mm-hmm. really sincere about this. And they'll go home and take the time to do the menu.
Yeah.
So I think that's a great, great way to approach it. Any other, as far as welfare, any other ways other than food orders that you were involved that on a regular basis or?
Not on a regular basis. We had a welfare committee meeting or provident living committee meeting once a month.
Okay.
That we would sit down and we would talk about specific families with specific needs. And that had we touched a little bit more on, you know, job skills and interview skills and life skills than we did just on food orders and financial needs. And we talked about different resources. We had our employment specialist attended that meeting, and he was a liaison with the DI employment program that they have, and we use those kinds of things. But
oh, cool, that's great. Yeah. So here's a big question with welfare, and maybe I don't know. I would imagine you had to tell people no sometimes. How did you tell people no, or was that?
Well, two things. One is that I would say I didn't ever really feel like I was the one to tell people no because I'm not the bishop and
the bishop sort of took over
over the resources of the ward. Right. But I did feel that I had a responsibility. I mean, I want to take as much of the load off the bishop as I can. Right.
Yeah,
he's
sure.
As hard as my job is, his is harder. So if I can keep him from having to deal with some of that, that's great. And so sometimes if we were sitting down and we were doing a food order and I could, and I felt like somebody was being overly
just out of bounds,
generous,
right?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yes. I would sometimes just say, you know, okay, remember this is for, we're just planning for 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. Or I would say something like, okay, so you've ordered 4 chickens and, you know, 4 roasts and, you know, 12 pounds of hamburger. That's this much meat per day, you know, because we're just doing 2 weeks. You've only got 14 days. So you've now got meat for this many days. Hmm. So is that how many, you know, do we really need 3 tubes of toothpaste for 2 weeks? Are you going to really go through 3 tubes of toothpaste in 2 weeks? You know?
Yeah.
And hopefully try and help them draw their own conclusions.
Hmm. I like that.
or, you know, if somebody needed a goods order, for clothing. Sometime I remember one time saying she was ordering clothing for a child that was coming, that was not here, you know, a baby that was coming. And, it was January and she was wanting to order baby clothes and sort of saying, okay, the baby's coming in May.
Yeah. Yeah. We got some time, right?
I know you're excited.
Yeah.
But if you go to buy clothes now, you're going to be getting winter clothes and the baby's going to get here in summer. And
right.
So the clothes that you're, so let's wait.
Yeah.
You know?
Awesome.
So I just tried to help people see things logically. And then if I felt concerned about it still, then I would just talk with the bishop because he's ultimately the one that signs off on the food order. And then he can make the decision whether or not to yay or nay that.
That's good. And again, it goes back to those boundaries you set up front kind of help you through the process of when you can say, listen, again, this is 2 weeks. We don't need four roasts, right? And so you can always go back to those. And that's, I think, why it's so crucial to set those boundaries up front. That's great. Let's go back to your list here of leadership principles. And the third one is provide opportunities, not obligations. I love how you said this. So I'm excited for you to elaborate.
Well, I mean, guilt, especially among women, I think, in the church, rears its head pretty readily. And I didn't want sisters who felt overwhelmed to then feel overwhelmed and like a failure because they didn't attend every single activity or didn't sign up for every single, you know,
compassionate service,
Right? And so part of that was helping my presidency and the committee chairs recognize that so that they didn't make people feel pressured. Like if we had an activity and only five people showed up, that's okay. That means five people needed it tonight and other people didn't. And that's okay. And it's a hard line to walk sometimes because you want to encourage participation and you want the people who prepared and, you know, for the event to feel like they did it for a reason.
Yeah.
And so you want to help in that way. You want to encourage people to attend, but I think it's a fine line between that and making people feel obligated to attend, particularly if they're already feeling overwhelmed.
Yeah, I bet.
And there are some things that should feel a little bit like obligations. Like you're a visiting teacher, you have an obligation to watch out for the sister that you're, you know, assigned to. I think that there's a little bit of an obligation there. I think sometimes it's okay to be able to call up and say, you know, this sister had a baby and you're her visiting teacher. Would you be willing to?
Yeah.
But the rest of the time, I think it's okay. Pass a sign up around. And if people don't sign up, you know, pass it around again. And then, or maybe ask the compassionate service to kick in or then, you know, and activities and things like that. I think, and if people turn down callings because they just feel like they can't right now, I think we need to be kind of compassionate with them in those cases because we don't always know what their situations are. It's hard. It's hard sometimes because on the leadership side of it, you want people to come and you want people to support. And
you sort of gauge yourself about how successful that activity was by how many people showed up.
When and I think that's not
unfair,
always the
right?
case. Yeah. Because if somebody really needed that activity, like if some poor mom was stuck home with the kids all week and was just feeling nuts and just needed an out for a couple of hours.
I know my wife's been that boat a lot of time. Yeah.
And there was an ice cream, you know, we're all going to get ice cream one night and only four people showed up. Kind of so what? Because if one of them was that woman and she felt like she got a chance to be a human again for a little while,
right?
Then that's okay. You know? And so it's kind of more that mentality of not stressing out so much if turnout isn't always huge. So we had some events where the turnout was huge and we had some where it was tiny. And I think you need to learn to be okay with either.
Yeah. Yeah. And I love that even those activities where, you know, even though they're not necessarily, you know, Relief Society sanctioned, where say we're going out for ice cream, but sometimes they happen organically and everybody's invited. And the nice thing is they cost zero in the budget, you know, for the auxiliary budget. But sometimes those can be more with the four people. Those can be more beneficial to the culture of the group rather than like this huge crafting activity that everybody doing a craft that nobody wants, right? you're a big crafter, I can tell, Amy.
Yeah.
This is
yeah.
Nice. So what else was I going to say with that? So how do you, as far as turning, you know, providing opportunities and not obligations, like, so how do you specifically go about that? Is it more of just not being overly disappointed when nobody comes, or is it the way you present it? You know, how do you go about that?
Well, with activities, we actually did, when I first came in, I mean, I didn't have a frame of reference, right? Because I was so new to the ward, and mm-hmm. I didn't know how the ward had been in the past. I only knew how it was kind of in that moment.
Yeah.
And we were going around, we did a lot of visits that when I first was put in, because I was just trying to know who people were. And it was interesting that the thing that I would hear a lot was that people would say things like, well, I don't know. I'm not really in the loop, or I'm not really in the, I don't really know. I'm home with the kids all the time, or I work full time. So I don't really, and everybody sort of like would talk about this imaginary loop that they didn't think that they were in.
Oh, interesting.
But what I found was that there was really no loop.
Yeah.
Like everybody thought that everybody else was in the loop, but there was no loop.
Yeah. Nobody was in the loop because there is no loop.
Everybody thought everybody else was in the loop, and really nobody was in the loop.
Okay. Interesting.
And so one of the things that we talked about was wanting to try and help the sisters in the ward feel connected to one another, and to give them opportunities to feel connected to each other and to know each other better. And trying to figure out ways to do that when we have, as I said, such a broad demographic. We had little old widows who went to bed at 7 or 8 o'clock at night, and we had young moms with, you know, babies at home, and we had empty nesters. And so we started out by providing a weekly activity, which seems like a lot, mm-hmm. but we purposely planned them to hit different demographics. And so we had a play group at 10 o'clock in the morning on a weekday once a month. Hmm. And we had a book group in the evenings at 7 o'clock once a month. And we had a girls' night out where we would go get ice cream at 8 o'clock once a month. And we tried a temple day or a lunch bunch day, you know, during the day once a month. And knowing and not expecting it, everyone to come to all of those, knowing that everyone was not going to come to those, but hoping that by providing at least something once a week, that if somebody needed a connection, that we were providing it for them.
That's great.
And in order to keep from any of us feeling overwhelmed, we would split it up, and I would take girls' night out, and one of my counselors would take the book group, and one of my counselors would take play group, and one of my counselors would take the lunch group or the temple group, you know. And so we each only had to do that one thing a month, but there was something every single week that somebody could attend if they wanted to.
And there's no added pressure on Mm-mm. Sundays, like, okay, we're having 4 activities. We'll see Mm-mm. all of you there, right?
Yeah. For if anybody wants to do this, this is what we're doing. If anybody needs to connect, if somebody needs to talk, if somebody just needs a social interaction,
yeah,
there's something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And like you mentioned, that hitting the different demographics, because, you know, a mom that's been home with screaming kids for a week, that's going to mean something. But maybe, you know, the divorced single mom who just needs some adult interaction, right? Or to be in that sisterhood. I can see how that could be very powerful. I love that idea.
Yeah.
For sure.
And we actually even had we have several divorced moms with young kids, single moms with young kids in our ward. And I think partly because we did some of these kind of smaller group activities where they were able to touch base and meet each other. We had them, one of the moms started a once a month family night where she would invite all the single moms would kind of get together with their kids.
Oh, that's great.
And they had that kind of little support group with among each other that was independent of anything the Relief Society presidency did, but they were part of the Relief Society, and they learned to support each other. And that was awesome. I thought
that's great. Number four, you said sometimes it's a jungle gym.
Yeah. So, I mean, we use this metaphor in the church a lot of a path. And I think it's really appropriate sometimes, especially when we're talking about following the Savior, or when we're talking about ordinances or things that need to be done in a specific order in a specific way. But I think the danger of that is that sometimes it's easy to look at somebody who's not conquered something or that does not have a testimony of something that we do and assume that they're farther behind us than we are. And because it's a path, right? You're all walking on the same path. But if you can view it kind of more as a, that's the best metaphor I could think of.
No, I think it works. Yeah.
If you could view it more as a jungle gym and we're all just trying to get to the top of the jungle gym and we're taking different paths, then somebody who doesn't have a testimony of how to wear the temple garment, but has a testimony of tithing is not better or worse than me. And somebody that, you know, I have a testimony of, fasting, but I don't really have a testimony of compassionate service. And somebody else has a really great testimony of service, but they struggle with gossiping, you know?
Yeah.
We all have our strengths and weaknesses. And if we can just like accept that everybody's working towards the same goal, but we're not necessarily taking the same path to get there, then it's easy to look at somebody and not dismiss them as, I don't think they'd be good for this calling because I saw this, you know, or I don't think this, and it's so much easier not to judge people if you can accept that everybody's kind of working on their own stuff the best way they know how.
Yeah. I love that. And I love the jungle gym analogy because it isn't a straight linear path, right? And sometimes I think naturally the leader, you know, the Lucite president is almost looked at like, oh, well, she's a Lucite president because she's leading the pack. She's further ahead than everybody else. When in reality,
oh, no.
we're all just on that jungle gym trying to get to wherever that is, right?
That maybe the top.
Yeah, the top or through this tube. And there's different ways to get there.
Yeah. You know?
So, and I love that. And it really creates more, be more sensitive to some of the perspectives in your Relief Society of what people are going through. And just because she, you know, doesn't have the same testimony as this other person, you know, let's not disqualify her from certain callings, you know,
or just different strengths and weaknesses, you know, like somebody who you knew had a tendency to gossip more than you would like, who was the first person to sign up to help with some compassionate service need. I mean, it's just, they've gained a testimony of this one issue and they've gotten this one issue under control and they just haven't quite figured the other one out yet. And we have to allow each other space and time to have our faults and work on our weaknesses and hopefully get better. And hopefully we're helping one another get better rather than judging one another for not being where we are.
That's awesome. I love that message. When I first read that, you know, sometimes it's a jungle gym. I thought you sort of meant sometimes it's just crazy and we're just there to survive. So much better
adequate analogy for either.
Okay. And then the last one, he said, this is his gig.
Yeah. And it's borrowed actually from our primary president, Emily Bullock, if you're listening, this is borrowed from you.
All credit to her.
And this is just has impacted me. We have a wonderful stake presidency. And when we had our, I think they did this with all the wards when they were having ward conference, but the week of ward conference, the stake leaders came and met with us and we went out on visits with our stake leader counterparts. And we met and we had a prayer and we went out on our visits and then we came back and met as a group and talked about how our visits went. And she talked about how nothing went right that night. Like the person that she was supposed to go out on visits with wasn't able to go and there was nobody else to go with her. And so the person going with her from the stake, I think was not even really part of the stake primary presidency, but anyway, somebody that she didn't even know. And then they were going to go, the person that they were going to go visit, it fell through at the last minute. And so she's here with the stake leader. And so they were going to swing by and visit somebody else, but they were either not home or were unavailable. And so she was thinking, so she was going to this, the only thing she just kept thinking of going to this house of this woman in our ward who's not an active member of the church and has three little boys who are primary age. And she'd sort of talked with her in passing before, and she had felt like it wasn't a real super comfortable interaction with them. And she was worried, but she didn't have any other ideas.
Yeah.
And so she thought, well, we'll just go knock on this door and go visit with this mom. And she went and knocked on the door and had this awesome visit with this mom where they talked about the boys and scouting. And she made a connection and realized that their boys were friends and played together. And she came out of it and she said, you know, I realized that this is his gig. Like I only have to do my best. And even if things feel like they're falling apart, as long as I'm trying, this is his gig and he'll make up the difference. Right. And I think if we can all always remember that, it takes so much of the pressure off about, you know, if we think we're successful or not, and if things are going the way we had hoped, or if an invitation was accepted or not, or any of it really, if whether we said something in a way that was clumsy, or that we worried that we hurt it, that we hurt somebody's feelings. I think in the end, if we trust the Lord and we know that the Lord knows that we're doing the best that we can, that He makes up the difference always, always.
Yeah. I love that principle. And it reminds me of times in, you know, as a leader, you sort of want to see progress happening and things coming together and that's encouraging, right? But sometimes it doesn't. And I would have to just stop and remind myself maybe not those exact words, but you know, this isn't my gig and it's not my job to figure this out. It's not my job to drag people to this activity or make them do this, or, you know, I encourage and lead the best I can. But at the end of the day, just take everything off your shoulders, put it on the Savior's mm-hmm. and say, this is your gig. And yep. I'm so grateful it's your gig.
And it was awesome because it's like this really, it's a relief. And it's at the same time, it's really empowering because you know you're not doing any of it by yourself.
Yeah.
Right? And however your effort goes, in the end, you can turn the rest of it over to the Lord. Mm-hmm. And it's, to me, that's, if you remember nothing else, I think that's the most helpful thing for me, is to be able to say, this is His, this isn't mine.
So let's talk about your being a Single Release Society president. Any interesting dynamics? I mean, I think there's some things that you would expect, but anything you didn't expect, or, you know, as far as being a leader that played into that, or did you see it as a weakness sometimes? Did you see it as a strength sometimes?
I think both. I think a weakness, kind of what I touched on earlier, in that it's hard for me to understand what some of the women are going through who are going through, you know, raising children or struggling with raising children or marital issues or divorce. Like, I can't really relate to any of that. Yeah. I can have compassion for them and I can try to support them as best I can, but I can't really relate to them in the same way that a buried mother could. Mm-hmm. So I think in that way, it could be perceived as a weakness, but I made up with it for it, I think, with awesome counselors who had all been there or were in the midst of that. Again, this is His gig, right? Like, I just do my best and He'll make up for it. I think the advantage is that in a lot of ways, it was probably easier for me. I didn't have to like try and balance my family's schedule with my meeting schedule. I didn't have to try and balance, you know, helping kids with school projects with preparing a lesson or with finding time to go do a food order or to go do visits or to attend a stake meeting. And I mean, I work full time, so there's that, but a lot of moms work full time too. And so they're trying to balance work and children and a calling. And so I think in some ways it was probably easier. I think it's both. I think every blessing brings with it a challenge, and every challenge brings with it a blessing. Yeah. And singleness brings both. There are blessings and challenges that come with that.
Yeah.
And I don't know. You'd have to ask.
Ask your bishop.
Yeah, wasn't it? Ask Bishop Lash whether or not.
Yeah. And again, I don't want to perceive it as a weakness or a strength, or, you know, I'm just curious. It is what it is. And, you know, mixing that with the culture of the church, where, you know, a lot of us were focused on the doctrine of families and those things. Sometimes it gets sticky and uncomfortable.
For sure.
You know.
And I think that has less to do with the calling that I have. I mean, I think that's tricky, whether or not you have a leadership calling. I think if you're single and you're going to attend a family ward, which this is just my personal opinion, but I think that's the better way.
Oh, okay.
At least for me, it was.
Okay.
I mean, I think that's a whole other thing.
Okay. Another episode.
That's a whole other episode.
Part two.
I think you can contribute more.
Yeah.
Right. And I think you can learn more by attending a family where it's harder, for sure. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you feel out of place more often, for sure.
Yeah.
But if your object is growth and development, then I think it's the better place to be. And I think you have to go into it determined to carve a place out for yourself in a family ward, because there isn't a natural place for singles always. So it's a challenge for sure. But I think, for me anyway, it's the better place to be.
Yeah. No, that's interesting. And you know, just as hearing you speak through that, I think just being a member of this church, you already have to come to terms with reconciling that, you know, the culture of the church and being single and, you know, the doctrines and things that being in a leadership role doesn't necessarily give you more to reconcile, right? It's just, it is what it is. And now I'm just I'm the Relief Society president within the same culture.
Right? Yeah. I mean, we all bring some basket of challenges with us, right?
Yeah.
It might be that I'm single. It might be that I'm divorced. It might be that I have a child that's struggling with the church. It might be that I have mental illness in my family. It might be that I have a family member that's dealing with same-sex attraction. It might be that I have a family member that's in jail. You know, if you made a list of all of the things that all of us are dealing with that we feel make us feel different.
Yeah.
Everybody would have something on that list. Everybody has something that they feel like is not the standard for an unquote normal LDS member, you know, active member of the church. And I think focusing on the thing that we think makes us different is not always the most productive.
Yeah, no, that's a great way to put it. And I guess it's encouraging to hear that being in leadership, you know, and I hope a lot of leaders out there listening, bishops and, you know, that are looking for Relief Society president or others, that they're not looking over those that are single because, like you said, they have so much to contribute. And, you know, and the little things where maybe the schedule's open a little bit more, maybe they can serve in a different way and more effectively in those areas. But it, hopefully there isn't this mold that we have to fit everybody to in order to serve in leadership, right? Mm-hmm. Obviously, there's somewhat of a worthiness mold, that obviously, but generally speaking, I think that's encouraging. Basically, two more questions. Okay. The second to last is visiting teaching. Any unique approaches you had? Oh my goodness, she just fell out of her chair. She's so. How did you go about it? What was your approach?
Well. When I first was put in, my approach was like not to change anything unless I absolutely had to because I didn't know what I was changing because I didn't know anybody. But then as I got to know sisters more and I got to just have an appreciation for the never-ending shuffle match that is visiting teaching, and I'm sure home teaching is the same way.
Sure.
I just had to stop worrying so much about trying to answer every person's request immediately. Like if somebody had a request about a companionship change, we'll write that down and we'll do that the next time we make changes. But if you make a change every single time somebody wants a change, you're making changes every single month. That's there are just better uses of everyone's time. Mm-hmm. I mean, you want to be able to help people match up with companions and with sisters who, you know, so that schedules match, so that it's easy for them to visit, and you want personalities to click so that they will do their visiting teaching and so that they have a connection with one another. But I think we tried to make changes maybe every 3 or 4 months and not more than that. And then we would do a whole bunch all at once because it caused a big domino effect. Mm-hmm. Aside from that, again, it comes back to like, this is his gig, right? I'm going to make the best assignment I can. I'm going to pray before I make my assignments, and I'm going to use my own common sense about who I think would be good matches. And then I'm going to trust that the Lord will make up for it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I love that because I think some leaders, and I remember this as an elders quorum president, like every change must be according to, you know, the notebook of God. And if I do one thing out of bounds, this could upset the ward and the structure altogether, you know, just sort of, you know, I'll move some things around. And I love the fact that you didn't just react to every change that people felt needed to be made.
Oh, I would spend my whole time doing visiting teaching if I did that.
Yeah. And so you just say, you know, I'll get to it, but it doesn't need to happen every month. And so I think that's a great approach. Last question is, as you have served as a Relief Society president, how has that made you a better disciple or follower of Jesus Christ?
You know, it's interesting. I was just talking with, I ran into the new, well, I had been emailing back and forth with our new Relief Society president this week, and I also happened to run into the new secretary. And I shared with them kind of the same thing that I shared with my presidency as we were going out, that it's a hard calling, but it's an amazing experience. And there's a part of me that wishes everybody could have the experience. of serving in this way. You hear Relief Society presidents, outgoing Relief Society presidents all the time talk about how amazed they are at the sisters in the ward and how grateful they are for the sisters that serve one another quietly. And I just kind of like, yeah, roll my eyes when they say that. Like, that's just part of like what they're supposed to say when they go out. But like to be in this position and to watch really and truly that really and truly does happen, that there are women that quietly and without being asked serve, and sisters that do their visiting teaching every week. And I'm even saying it out loud and I'm listening to it and it sounds so dumb, but when you're in the position of being responsible for those sisters, you become so grateful for that. You become so grateful for the women who just show up, and the women who love one another, and the women who are doing their best to be disciples of Christ, because you see how much stronger it makes the ward and the neighborhood and the church as a whole. I've become really grateful for that, and it helped me develop a greater appreciation for the women in my ward and who are my sisters, right? Who are my sisters in Christ? Those are my sisters. And that's been the coolest thing for me, is to see that and to see their example. I have a much different perspective. And I don't even know that I can put it into words. I feel sort of at a loss for words right now, but I have a much different perspective on the gospel and what it means to serve than I did before. And I remember thinking, my sister-in-law had been a Relief Society president before, and I said to her after I'd been released, I'm like, I feel like I would sign up for any sign-up sheet that came around now, because you become so grateful even for the women who will sign up to help. You become so grateful for that because you're responsible to see that it gets done, and for the people who are willing to help. And I don't know that makes me, I guess that makes me a better disciple of Christ, because it makes me more willing to serve, and it makes me step out of myself a little more and more willing to do for others.
That concludes my interview with Amy Durham. What a gem she is. I'm so grateful that she allowed me to interrupt her workday and come into her office there and ask her some questions. I definitely learned a lot, and I think this would be a fantastic interview to share with new Relief Society presidents, those that are established and been doing a few years. Whatever it is, they would benefit from this. Even bishops that are, obviously all bishops interact with the Relief Society presidents to some degree, and there's a lot to learn here from her five leadership principles. Now, if you head on over to leadinglds.org, I think you may find, hopefully by the time this is released, our new website will be up and rolling, and I hope you like it, love any feedback, but that donation link is definitely there, present, and available to be clicked. So I encourage you to go to leadinglds.org and contribute. All we ask is $1 a month, just $1, folks, for the content that we put out on Leading LDS, and we have bigger and better plans here in the near future, and we look forward to being able to accomplish those with your help. $1 a month. We need everybody's help to make this happen. So until next time, be a leader and not a calling.
It came as a result of the position of leadership which was imposed upon us by the God of heaven, who brought forth a restoration of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And when the declaration was made concerning the only true and living church upon the face of the earth, we were immediately put in a position of loneliness. The loneliness of leadership, from which we cannot shrink nor run away, and to which we must face up with boldness and courage and ability.